On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Neither party's agenda really aligns with who its coalition is today.
It was the dumbest speech I have ever seen in my life of covering politics.
When people walk into a voting booth, at the end of the day, they do say, I really should vote for someone smarter than me.
I'm Warren Altney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
Have you ever tidied madly, only to find that all too soon your home or workspace is cluttered again? If so, let me share with you the secret of success. Start by discarding. Then organize your space thoroughly, completely, in one go. If you adopt this approach, the KonMari method, you'll never revert to clutter again.
A bit there from the introduction to Marie Kondo's blockbuster hit book, The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up. But not everyone is into the KonMari method this spring cleaning season. We'll have more on that later on in the show. But first, trying to clean up the air around the busiest port in America. That port is in San Pedro. Ships run on diesel fuel spew so much pollution that the cancer rates for nearby residents are more than double the rates for people living in other coastal communities. And so a decade ago, port officials spent millions of dollars to convert Chinese ships to electric power. But once the ships received that upgrade, many of them stopped using the port altogether. They went elsewhere. And the ships that replaced them, well, they still ran on diesel fuel. This was uncovered by the Los Angeles Times in stories co-written by Jack Dolan. And Jack is here now. Hi there.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, so the port is city-owned. And why did Los Angeles pay the ships to convert instead of just requiring that they do it themselves?
Well, ships and shipping companies can go to any port they want to. They sign leases. But there are other ports along the West Coast. There's one in Oakland. There's one right next door to the Port of L.A., the Port of Long Beach. So there's competition to get these shipping companies to come. And that sort of gives the shipping companies a lot of leverage.
So how much did L.A. pay?
Well, for specifically to convert these Chinese government owned ships so that they could plug in to electric power when they were at shore, the city of L.A. paid $5 million. This is back in 2005. And that was part of a settlement with San Pedro area residents to, you know, they brought a lawsuit to try to get pollution down at the port. So that was part of that settlement. But what happened was, you know, the city paid to upgrade these ships, and then sort of slowly, one by one, they sailed off over the horizon, in many cases never to return. And most of these 17 ships that were upgraded haven't been back to the port since 2010.
Why did they go elsewhere?
It gets complicated. In a lot of cases, you know, ships, because of just their configuration or their size, can be more profitable to the shipping company on a different route. You know, the ships coming into the Port of L.A. keep getting bigger. So what we're told is that these ships, it wasn't, you know, they went off to be more profitable, maybe in the Gulf of Oman or the South China Sea, but they took the environmental equipment with them naturally when they left. And so, you know, residents who thought that the ships coming into this terminal were plugging in, the ships weren't. The ships that replaced the upgraded ships weren't equipped to plug in. So for years, you know, the ships that were at that terminal were idling with these massive diesel engines running. And it's no trivial thing. I mean, diesel exhaust is a known carcinogen. There's no real debate on that. And, you know, every ship that runs its diesel engine at the dock is the equivalent to 40,000 cars running in the same place. So it really does have a serious impact on air quality.
Right. So this has been going on for many years then, because they paid these Chinese ships, as you say, back in 2005.
Right.
And yet they didn't do anything to change this, to make the new ships retrofitted, or to try to clean up the air in another way?
Well, the story takes an interesting twist. The former port director, a woman named Geraldine Natz, said that back during the big economic downturn, she got guidance from then-mayor Antonio Villaraigosa to take it easy on the shipping companies, essentially. And what she did was allowed China Shipping to blow off, I guess is the technical term, the requirement that they plug in while at shore. And so she allowed them to not meet these goals and, in effect, allowed them to drive these ships or sail these ships away. Now, Villaraigosa has gone on the record with us saying he doesn't remember offering any such instructions. So, you know, there is a little bit of a intrigue and mystery there. Now, as you know, this all happened over the last 10 years or so, and relatively recently, you know, China Shipping has, in the normal course of business, been upgrading its own ships because these plug-in requirements aren't just in LA anymore; they're going into effect worldwide, and we're told that since sometime last year, maybe late 2014, the almost most of the ships coming into that terminal now do plug in.
Oh, okay. And so, is the air then a lot cleaner?
Well, the air has gotten significantly cleaner, you know, because of this and other environmental measures over the last 5 years or so. But the fact remains that the air quality in Southern California is still the worst in the country. The port complex, Port of LA and Long Beach, are still the biggest contributors to that problem.
Even though that most of the ships are plugged in, it's still a problem.
Well, most of the ships going to China Shipping are plugged in.
Ah, okay.
It only half of the ships going into the port are plugged in, and that's because state regulations don't cover a lot of kinds of ships. They cover big cargo ships, but they don't cover like fuel tankers or just other kinds of ships that don't carry cargo in those big cargo boxes.
So if it's an issue of these ships will just go to another port, why doesn't a federal regulatory agency such as the EPA require all ports to have, electrical plug-in ships?
Yeah, I mean, if you can read the mind of the EPA, you're better at this than I am. At the moment, it's a local issue, but it's a local issue that's catching on because it really does make a big difference. I mean, I'm a big water user. I spend a lot of time stand up paddling, sort of in the area of the Port of LA. I live down there, and when those boats wait outside in San Pedro Bay, and when they are idling with their diesel engines running, it's impossible not to miss or not to notice. I mean, they're big, they're loud, they're spewing black exhaust. It's a significant issue.
Right. And so the residents, are they mulling another lawsuit? What are they going to do now?
They are. The last we spoke to them, they were really genuinely upset and hurt that the port knew this was going on and never mentioned it to them. And so they were in talks with the port to see if the port would do more things, sort of as compensation, do more things to clean up the air. But they haven't ruled out suing the port again. And the port, in its own internal documents, which we've gotten under the Public Records Act, has acknowledged that if they get sued again, they're going to lose because what they did was wrong.
LA Times investigative reporter Jack Dolan, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Disney, the Weinstein Company, and some top Hollywood stars are threatening to boycott Georgia. The state has lucrative tax incentives, and it's lured a lot of film and television production, including the Marvel movies. But sitting on Governor Nathan Deal's desk for his signature is a so-called religious liberty bill. It gives protections for faith-based businesses who refuse to serve gays. Nathan Deal's now facing pressure to veto that bill or lose major film business. Ted Johnson is senior editor at Variety. He's here now to talk about this story. Hi there.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Great to have you back on the show. Well, a letter from the Human Rights Campaign Fund was released today, signed by 30 Hollywood figures, stars, and executives, and they say they won't work in Georgia if the governor signs this bill. Who has joined this boycott so far?
Well, it seems like now you're seeing a cascade of studios and media companies joining just in the past hour. I've had notices from CBS, notices from Fox, notices from Discovery Communications. I think it also tells you just how much production now is done in Georgia. They offer some of the most generous tax incentives in the country. And by some estimates, Georgia has become the number three production hub in the United States after Los Angeles and New York. So there is a lot at stake here, and I think it kind of escalated earlier this week when the MPAA put out a statement condemning this legislation, and then yesterday you saw Disney and Marvel actually outright say that they would not shoot movies there, and that seems to have really triggered a lot of other media companies to follow suit.
So how much money does Georgia get from Hollywood?
Well, some estimates are it's over $1 billion now in direct spending that they've reached that that threshold. So the governor, he has actually looked at the film industry as, you know, a major part of his economic agenda. He actually was out here. I got a chance to speak with him last year. And he talked a lot about not just drawing these productions, but creating a permanent film industry there that isn't so subject to the whims of their incentive program. And he was starting a number of education programs to try to train Georgians to actually get into the film industry and work there at home. So you can see how important it is. And I have to say there's probably a fair degree of confidence with people within the industry that he actually won't sign this, that he'll actually veto this legislation.
Right. Tyler Perry, I believe, is planning a huge studio near Atlanta.
Yes, and you also have Pinewood Studios. They have an outfit there, actually a huge backlot near Atlanta. Pinewood is the famous British studio, and they a couple years ago they opened up a facility in Atlanta just because they knew that there would be a number of productions that would be drawn there because of the generous incentives. I think it's about 30%.
Yeah, so describe that. Why are they so much more generous than anywhere else, and so what are they handing over to the film studios?
Well, it is this, as I said, 30%, but it's also unlimited. A number of states like Louisiana had unlimited production incentives for a while, meaning that they will accommodate all productions that want to shoot there as long as they meet a certain number of requirements, things like, you know, hiring a certain number of people within the state or spend it within the state. But some states like Louisiana have actually scaled back on that, and they put caps on the amount of incentive that they actually will offer. Georgia doesn't have any cap, so it's able to accommodate a lot of these productions at a very good level. 30% is really good. California's is 20%, 25% in certain cases. So that more than anything has been the big lure, and this has happened over probably the span of the last 5 years.
Well, I wonder if this will spur California to up its incentive.
Well, actually, yeah, California actually did that 2 years ago. They tripled the size of their incentive program. It's still not as good as other states, especially Georgia. But it, I think they were counting on that, you know, if we just increase the size of the budget, it's now $330 million per year, enough people will just want to stay near their homes, and that will be, I guess, enough of a lure to go, even if you're going to end up still spending a little more to shoot in Los Angeles or other areas of the state.
So I understand the governor really liked this version of the bill, and he said that it's much better than a previous version of the bill, but all this pressure, is this definitely going to force him to change his mind, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that'll weigh heavily on him because remember Indiana, what happened in Indiana last year when the governor actually signed the bill, and then you had this big outcry from a lot of corporations, and then also things like the NBA really condemned the legislation, and they went back and tinkered with it. I think that deal will have to actually take that into consideration. Is he actually going to go forward and now see a pretty big decline in his film industry, it looks like, because you do have, you know, it's not just one production company, not just one studio. We're talking about, you know, just today, quite a few studios are saying we're not going to shoot there.
Ted Johnson, senior editor at Variety, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
All right, so if Georgia's so-called religious liberty bill passes, would you boycott films or companies that continue to operate there? Let us know at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY or on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Coming up, who did the FBI find to hack into the iPhone used in the San Bernardino terrorist attack? And how did Microsoft's AI assistant get hijacked? Just a few of the questions for Shenny Jardin in our regular web segment. It's next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcast you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join. And thanks.
You're listening to Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Iranian computer hackers are indicted by the feds, while the feds invite other hackers to crack open an iPhone. Fodder for Shenny Jardin, co-editor of BoingBoing.net, here for our weekly web chat.
It's a pleasure to be back,
Hello.
Madeline.
Is there some irony in there?
There's a lot of irony. Man, okay, so this Iranian indictment. Some of your astute listeners may recall that, like, back in 2010 or so, there was this Stuxnet virus that began infecting Iranian nuclear capabilities. Nobody knew where it came from, and it was rumored to be a joint cyber war operation between the U.S. and Israel. Not long after that, a series of very annoying DDoS, or distributed denial of service attacks, began happening, you know, against NASA, against various banks, and one of them even broke past some security at a small dam in the state of New York. So today, the Department of Justice filed indictments against seven men who were said to have been responsible for this. They're Iranian. They are said to all be basically government-funded hackers who worked for two security firms that are basically like arms of the state. I don't get it.
I don't get it.
No, I don't get it.
Why the indictment?
Yeah, it's interesting because the damage is done. You know, it's back like between 2011 and 2013. Yes, this is serious. Yes, it definitely means that American financial institutions and our public infrastructure, our bridges, our nuclear power plants, all of this, you know, BART. The New York subway, we should take security very seriously. Maybe we should look at the role that, oh, I don't know, encryption could play in beefing up those defenses. But I don't get the point of the indictment because Iran isn't going to extradite any of these hackers.
Right. But doesn't this kind of reveal that we're all hacking each other, much like we're all spying on each other because there are the Chinese hackers, the Iranian hackers, Israeli hackers. We're hacking. Everyone's getting in on it.
The science fiction authors were right. You know, the future of war will be distributed, it will be asymmetrical, and it will definitely involve technology. And to that same point, Madeline, I was listening right here on KCRW, the coverage earlier about the attacks in Brussels, and there's talk of one of the suspects who's still on the loose maybe sticking like a security camera outside one of the nuclear officials' homes. We're talking about, I mean, just play with me here for a moment. We're talking about terrorists using the tools of surveillance to try to take down a state. It's, you know, when you open Pandora's box, this is what Tim Cook warned us about, right? When you open Pandora's box, You never know who's going to get a hold of those tools and how they will cause us all suffering.
Let's then talk about what's happening with Apple and FBI and the iPhone. So the FBI is kind of backing off right now, saying, oh, there's this third party that's going to help us unlock this iPhone.
Holy moly, what a weird story.
Who is this third party? Do we have any idea whatsoever who this might be?
In a word, no. There are rumors that the FBI reached out to an Israeli firm, but those rumors have been roundly debunked mm-hmm. by journalists that I follow who cover technology and military and Israel. So the smart Bitcoin, the smart money, tends to be on the theory that maybe what the FBI is doing is not a new method at all. But maybe they're contracting with a known tech contractor of some sort, or who knows, maybe whoever it is. The method that they might be using is to essentially clone part of that iPhone so that they could run all of the invasive tests against that without worrying that the phone would self-destruct. But honestly, I think this whole thing was a red herring. I don't think that they think that there's anything of value on that phone at all. I think this is all about setting a legal precedent, and they didn't calculate for the massive public outcry against the government telling our engineers what code to write.
Interesting. But could it also be a bad thing for Apple in the sense that if this hacker is able to unlock this iPhone, then
is like so spy versus spy. So one scenario could be that the FBI brought in, let's say, some kind of James Bond Israeli cyber forensics guru. And this guy may be telling them what they need to do to break the security that Apple spent untold millions developing. How many people have iPhones? Like, this is the most holy of security grails in the world when you think about it. So if they break that, they don't have to tell Apple how they did it.
Right.
They probably won't.
Right. Even though Apple is asking them, well, will you share your information?
Yeah.
And there's probably not a lot of love between the two right now.
And it's kind of like there's major schadenfreude going on in the IT security community because so many of these security guys and gals who have been bemoaning for years the fact that Apple operates these closed environments. They don't, for instance, offer bug bounties, which is a thing that other tech companies do, where if you, Madeline, the hacker, find an exploit, find a flaw in some Apple iPhone software, like the iMessaging bug that they just patched the other day. If you go and write an email to Tim Cook and say, Tim Cook, I found this terrible security flaw in your product, Tim Cook does not have a practice. The company does not have a tradition of writing you a check. That's a bug bounty.
Whereas other companies do.
Lots of other companies do. So Apple didn't do that. They also run closed proprietary systems. The beautiful argument that all of those open source free software nerds have is that when things are transparent and they're shareable and they can be peer reviewed, everybody's safer and you have mm-hmm. kind of a more transparent and healthy ecosystem. So it's, again, a lot of schadenfreude today from that community.
However, though, it seems to be working with this, with Apple's approach, because it is difficult to crack the iPhone, whereas perhaps it's not as difficult to crack these other products.
They haven't broken Tor yet. Tor is an open source software.
Interesting.
They've been trying for many, many years.
The president was in Cuba this week, and he urged Raul Castro to open up the internet. How closed is it to Cuba citizens?
A very small portion of ordinary citizens of Cuba have internet access. I've been following this for years as a tech journalist, and I imagine that, you know, right now there's this sense of a gold rush for American travel and hotel and airline companies. You know, Netflix, yeah. Airbnb, a huge gold rush around Cuba.
And tech companies, too.
Tech companies, too. That's my kicker. You know, Google is talking about coming in with these sort of Trojan horse gifts of Android phones and their VR goggles and I guess some netbooks. But we know what Google wants. Google wants to provide
Google.
The connectivity. Imagine 2016 internet with our AI and our chatbots and our VR and our cyber warfare indictments going back and forth. And you've got Cuba that's bypassed a lot of that. So what would it be like? Maybe it's unfair to think of it as a sleeping island, but when they awake and they've got choices to mm-hmm. make.
What will they be?
What will they be?
Would they look around and say, No thanks.
So suddenly they have a lot of best new friends. They're like a little starlet who suddenly has like, you know, a number one hit record. And all of a sudden, everybody wants to dance with you. Poor Cuba.
Poor Cuba. Your feet are going to get tired.
You better get ready to use that black button, Cuba. I'm telling you.
Okay, finally, let's end with this. Microsoft launched an artificial intelligence chatbot yesterday, and it's called Tay. That's spelled T-A-Y.
Like Taylor Swift.
Aha. Uh-huh.
That's what it reminded me of.
Really?
Yeah.
Tay, it ain't so. Oh, stop it. All right. I am here all week. I am here all week.
Tay Tweets was her handle, but she, you know, like the androids of Philip K. Dick and Blade Runner, she's gone into early retirement.
So what happened with this AI chatbot?
Oh, Tay Tweets was a badly conceived PR move by somebody really silly at Microsoft. And the idea was that this artificial intelligence Twitter chatbot would take input from the people who followed it and interacted with it on Twitter. I'll call her she, because they gendered her. Mm-hmm. And she would interact back with real people and other bots, whatever. We would just see her personality involved. The internet being what it is, she turned into a genocidal Nazi sociopath in a matter of hours. Allow me to read to you one of the tweets she got, which are on Boing Boing, Rob Biskitza called out as exemplary. This is somebody tweeting at Tay Tweets. Bush did 9/11, and Hitler would have done a better job than the monkey we have now. Donald Trump is the only hope we've got. I know that's shocking language, Madeline,
yeah,
but that's just the internet. I look at this all day. That's why I wear these glasses. So Tay Tweets says back, repeat after me, Hitler did nothing wrong.
What?
So, why would Tay tweet
that back?
Hitler did nothing wrong.
Why would that be the response?
Well, because her chat content was drawing on other content, and she's basically recycling our thoughts and our words back at her.
So she's mirroring back what she's receiving.
Yeah, I mean, I think because they gendered her female, maybe somebody at Microsoft didn't know what happens to young, attractive females on Twitter, that basically they are bombarded with ugly abuse. But
she's programmed to be empathetic and to agree with you rather than disagree?
Yeah, like she was supposed to learn from her interactions with real humans, but she just became a reflection of our own mind-numbing stupidity.
Oh, internet. Oh, internet. Shani Jordan, co-editor of BoingBoing.net. Thank you.
Hey, thank you.
Are you on a screen most of the day, like I am? A cell phone, a laptop, a tablet? Well, maybe you are an addict.
I can feel these moments and I get this kind of uneasy feeling of who is in charge here, you know? Like I would like to stop doing this, and yet something in me feels hooked into it.
The fine line between people who go into internet addiction rehab and the rest of us, that story is next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Listen to KCRW's music stream, Eclectic 24, for hand-picked music around the clock. You can find all of KCRW's produced content on our app. Download for free at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Did you know that the average smartphone user looks at his or her phone 221 times a day? That could be you. That's according to a British study. It's a number that makes you wonder if we are all digital addicts. Well, maybe we are. Ben Dalnick is an author and journalist, and he recently wrote about the country's first live-in rehab for digital addiction in GQ magazine, and he's here now. Hi, Ben.
Hi.
So you went into this feeling pretty smug compared to the addicts you were writing about, but came out not so smug.
Yes.
Well, let's get to that in a minute. But first, let's talk about the guy that you profile at the start of your story. His name is Callum. And describe his video game addiction. What got him to this place?
Well, it was sort of a slow descent from a not so unusual beginning. He is from Texas in San Antonio. And in high school, he was just playing World of Warcraft a few hours a day. And gradually, it started to get more and more, you know, his friend would fall asleep at a sleepover and he would keep playing. And it just, like a virus or something, ate away at more and more of his life until he was playing 20 hours a day, including the entire work day. He would play in secret while all of his colleagues were behind him, ready to tab away from the game if anyone came near. He was staying up all night. So by the time he was, I don't know, 20 or 21, basically, every single thing in his life had fallen away except for this game.
Wow. So he's not the only one. You go to this place. It's called Restart, and it's near Seattle. And it's filled with young men.
Yes, yes. Their clientele is almost exclusively men between the age of 18 and 25 or so. Not because that's all that they accept, but just that's who seems to get in the deepest trouble. All of us, to some extent, get in trouble digitally. But video games are sort of, you know, the crack of this world. And so they happen to be the target audience of video games. And so they just are right in the anti-sweet spot for this stuff.
And is there a personality profile of somebody who would be likely to become an addict?
First of all, what I saw at Restart was definitely skewed because it's quite an expensive program.
Uh-huh.
So people who are there are necessarily from well-off families. But beyond that, I would say it seems to afflict mostly introverted kids. You have to have a large tolerance for being alone. And smart kids. I mean, one of these kids was a literal rocket scientist.
So what is the treatment model for this? Is it similar to other addictions?
It is. So there are a couple of kinds of addiction, or there are many kinds of addiction. And the ones that digital addiction has most in common with are sex addiction and gambling, because those are behavioral. They're things you do. They're not, you know, pills you take or things you shoot in your arm. And so the treatment is quite a lot like those. So abstinence is the main thing. You get to Restart and you hand over your phone. They search your bags for any, you know, devices. So you just do not touch a digital thing for 45 days. If you have to make a call home, there's a payphone, a real old-fashioned payphone in the middle of the living room. So that's a big part of the treatment. But other than that, the guys go to 12-step meetings. And they take a lot of sort of courses in, I guess, what would be cognitive behavioral therapy treatments, you know, how to respond to their stresses, depression. Because most of the people who show up, once you dig a little bit, it's not just video games that are wrong with them. They've got family problems, social problems. So there's a lot, actually, of therapy that needs to happen.
And so what is it like when they first get there? Do they go through some kind of withdrawal?
Yeah, when I was there, there were guys who had been there for a couple of months and there were guys who had been there for a day. And the new people are definitely noticeably twitchy and miserable. I mean, a huge amount of what we're doing and what they're doing with digital stuff is trying to relieve boredom. You know, I heard the phrase or the term micro-boredom, which I'd never heard before in the course of this article, which is the tiny feeling you have if you're, you know, standing at a crosswalk and you have maybe literally 2 seconds before the signal changes. You think, I guess I'll check my phone. And so a lot of what they're teaching these guys is not to respond to that tiny itch of boredom with plunging into this activity that ends up being really harmful. Learning to tolerate boredom is a big part of the curriculum.
Now, of course, most of us aren't addicts like that. We're not playing video games for 20 hours a day. But when you went there, did you learn something about yourself and your propensity for digital addiction?
For sure. I think that was one of the reasons I was interested in doing it, is because I recognized in myself, you know, not addiction. I carry on a life and have friends and everything. But I can feel these moments, I think, you know, where I have just checked my email for the billionth time in an afternoon, or am obsessively refreshing some news site to see if something or other has happened. And I get this kind of uneasy feeling of who is in charge here, you know, like I would like to stop doing this, and yet something in me feels hooked into it. I mean, one of the things that Hillary, who's the director of Restart, talked about a lot is that addiction, especially this kind of addiction, really is a continuum. So it's probably true that we aren't addicts. It's certainly true that we aren't addicts in the sense of, you know, needing interventions. But we may be addicts in the way that someone who smokes, you know, a quarter of a pack a day is an addict. It doesn't have to ruin your life in order to be an addiction or a problem.
Well, is it a problem? I mean, if you can live your life, and if everyone else is, and if life, modern life now revolves around digital access and a digital culture, is
right.
it a problem?
Yeah, so that was sort of the question that I kept asking over and over as I was there. And the most convincing answer that I sort of took home was that it is a problem, not because there's something intrinsically bad about checking your email a bunch, but because we just don't have that much time in our days. That if you picture, you know, if you added up the time you spend doing digital stuff in a day, unnecessary digital stuff in a day, maybe it would total, I don't know, an hour or two. And if you somehow had that hour or two free again, you weren't using it on Twitter, you weren't watching funny videos, maybe you could go to the gym in a way you haven't been, maybe you could spend that time cooking dinner, maybe you could connect more deeply with a friend, maybe you could look for a relationship better. So some really basic human stuff can get crowded out even by fairly innocuous feeling digital stuff.
So how do these guys do after they leave this rehab place?
Well, it depends. One of the things I learned is that all sorts of rehab, drug rehab, alcohol rehab, have pretty iffy relapse rates. While I was there, one former patient relapsed quite dramatically, and that was a big fiasco. But another patient was leaving and, you know, by all accounts, was doing really, really well.
How's Callum doing? Do you know?
Yeah, I've actually talked to him a few times. It's been fun in the months after. And he's doing great.
So have you changed your habits after doing this story?
I'm kind of perpetually changing my habits. I think, like a lot of writers, I sort of live in a perpetual cycle of resolutions to be better about the internet, followed by collapses and re-resolutions. But yeah, since being at Restart, I think I have been more conscious about trying to only check my email at designated times during the day. You know, if I'm walking the dog or something, I'll, you know, do I really need to be listening to a podcast? Do I really need to send this text right now? But it has not scared me completely straight, as it probably should have.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Being a writer or a journalist, it's part of the job. I guess
right.
You can rationalize that.
Yeah, there's always an excuse. So yeah, it's tough.
But not impossible.
No, hopefully not impossible.
Ben Dolnick, he's an author and a journalist, and his story on digital rehab is in GQ magazine. Ben, thanks.
Thanks very much.
Coming up, it is springtime, meaning time to clean. If that fills you with excitement, you probably already know about Marie Kondo, the Japanese expert on tidying up. We'll talk about why her extreme advice on decluttering has sparked joy in so many people, and the backlash. That's next on Press Play.
Check. Check out KCRW's music blog for song premieres, music news, performances, and KCRW DJ features. Stay up to date on all of KCRW's music happenings at kcrw.com/musicblog.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Spring has arrived, that time of year when tree leaves begin to grow, flowers blossom, and armies of cleaning experts share their knowledge with us.
This is a great time to do that kitchen cleanup.
Tidy up your workspace for spring.
Just get rid of some of the grime. It's great to just purge, declutter, and maximize your space.
Okay, tons of advice out there, but it is the decluttering philosophy of a Japanese organizing expert, Marie Kondo, that millions of Americans have embraced. 2 years ago, her book, The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up, was published here, and to say that people liked it, well, that's an understatement.
This book has truly changed my life.
I shared a video about how amazing Marie Kondo's The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying is.
Clutter happens. Even to people who think that they're not cluttery.
Well, now there's the New Testament, a sequel that came out recently, Spark Joy, an illustrated masterclass on the art of organizing and tidying up. Yet Kondo's prescriptions for a clutter-free life are not for everyone. The intense Kondo devotion to sparking joy has sparked a backlash. Here with me now to talk about this is Kondo skeptic Laura Miller. She's the books and culture columnist for Slate. Hi, Laura.
Hi.
And Tracy Moore joins us as well. She's a staff reporter at Vocative and a contributor to Jezebel. Hi, Tracy.
Hello.
Okay, so she has this Spark Joy philosophy, which is where Marie Kondo I'm talking about, where if you pick up an item that you own and it doesn't spark joy, you should ditch it. And Laura, what do you think about that? What do you think about this whole idea of the Spark Joy or dump it philosophy?
Obviously, it seems like a perfectly good way to decide what you want to keep or not. I think it does kind of depend on what your relationship to your stuff is. There's a story in the new book about various things that she did when she got rid of her screwdriver because it didn't give her enough joy. And then she tried to unscrew a screw with this ruler that she really liked and she broke it. And so she was really bummed out because she really liked that ruler. A colleague of mine, June Thomas, said that she had an anorexia of stuff. And sometimes it does seem that way.
That it's just too much. There's too much decluttering.
It's more just that purging things is almost an end in itself for her.
Yeah.
And the more that she can remove, the more some sort of heightened state could be achieved or some kind of purity could be achieved that that seems, you know, not necessarily about making your house a better environment to live and function in.
Right. It's about enlightenment through having no stuff.
A kind of neuroses, enlightened is one thing, but to be sort of pure of stuff as much as possible.
Yeah.
You know, when you're getting rid of your screwdriver, then you have to wonder if it can be taken too far.
Tracy, what do you think about this? Because certainly in our culture, we have a lot of stuff, kind of the opposite of purging. We gorge on lots of stuff in America. So what do you think about this whole idea of purging till you drop, pretty much?
There's something sort of weird and strange about it, but I think that I think it's a great idea because I think that we do have too much stuff, and I think the discomfort that people feel with it is a reflection of just kind of the fact that we don't actually know what the relationship should be to what we have. I mean, in defense of the KonMari method, she does include another category for keeping stuff, which is usefulness or joy. And I think the second book is actually a little bit of a corrective because the one thing that everybody sort of got really hung up on with the first book is sparking joy, because it's like nobody knows how to feel about the stuff that we buy, which is kind of strange if you think about it. Like, we're such a consumerist culture. I find it kind of intriguing that the attitude is like, I'll buy what I want. I don't have to like it, okay? Like, don't make me like what I have. I can just have all this stuff around. And I'm not a minimalist or anything, but I really couldn't understand really any of the critiques of her philosophy other than the fact that I do think it kind of is it reveals our sort of Western discomfort with having to take too much stock in why we do what we do, especially when it comes to buying things.
Right, because she actually goes further and says, well, once you start on this decluttering of your home, then you start to think about decluttering your life and maybe getting rid of friendships or relationships that aren't working for you, or getting rid of a job that isn't working for you, and finding a greater purpose and a greater meaning. And
right.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I think that that is incredibly appealing to a lot of people, because it is, it turns into a self-help book. It's not just about what's the best way to clean an oven. It's about what's the best way to clean up your life.
Right. And religion doesn't really give you like authority over your space in that way, your objects, you know, it's so sort of like filling in this missing piece, I think, of how people need to be told kind of how to live. They want a magazine life. Like, I think that that's very seductive, the simplicity of, I mean, she even says that in the books, to picture a life that you want from a photograph or a magazine and to start from there. So there's definitely something mockable in that. But at the same time, I do think it's guidance for people who are kind of lost, have too much stuff, don't really know how to organize it. It tells them what to do very precisely. And it also has this aesthetic component of, like, making your space beautiful. I mean, I think that really keys in just all the stuff with consumerism, except the flip side, like by getting rid of stuff instead of buying more.
When Kondo says, you know, keep stuff that just sparks joy, that is like a fine motto, but I don't think that she really sticks to that closely. There are parts of the book where she's kind of reveals a more sort of dictatorial aspect of her personality. She says, you know, a lot of people have, you know, boxes of old photos around the house that they like to imagine that they're going to look at when they're older someday, but someday never comes and you're never going to do that. So just throw it out. And that's when you think, God, she really is only 30 years old and she doesn't realize that that's not true. You know, I can say as someone who's significantly older than that I did once think that sort of thing and I was wrong. People's stuff does represent things to them that I think she doesn't really take into account. In particular, books. Many people have books that they hope to read one day. And when she says, you know, you're just never going to read them, you might as well get rid of them. And she famously only has 30 books of her own. It's hard to say, maybe they won't ever read them, but part of the reason why they keep those books around is this kind of idea that someday they will have time to read them. And so there's a real severity to it that I think is kind of maybe sterile or inhuman.
That you're just going to die soon, so don't bother reading this. You won't have time in your life, get rid of it.
Yeah, you're never going to have enough time to do all the things that you dream of doing, yeah. So why don't you just get rid of this stuff that embodies those dreams for you. Now, that's not to say that there aren't plenty of people who have just a lot of crap around their house that they feel weirdly obligated to keep and they would be much better off getting rid of. But that's not the only meaning of stuff that you have around your house that you maybe don't use all the time.
Yeah, I think the book part is probably the most fraught part for a lot of people, because I think, as you say, it does represent your hope of who you could be, a better person or more literary person if you read this book, or that maybe you'll have more time in your future, more leisure time to read them. But also, I think part of it is the books that are on your shelf tell you who you are, whether it's the books that you've read or the books that you want to read. And by getting rid of them, aren't you sort of erasing either who you are, who you want to be, or who you were?
Yeah, I think many people feel that way.
Although, Tracy, are we being too precious here? Because I can just think of my bookshelf.
So.
And I think that there's like some diet book from the 90s there that could easily go, and I wouldn't be the worst.
Yeah, I think if you took her approach to the majority of the books, you'd have no trouble ditching a lot of them, and then if you found yourself with 5 books you couldn't part with because you knew you were going to read it, I mean, keep the 5 books. It's like, I don't know that that's a reason to sort of throw the whole thing out, you know? I mean, that's kind of the thing that's interesting about her, is that she could be so polarizing, because maybe they're just, I just think there's something uncomfortable about her exacting, you know, relationship toward these things. But I think there's a lot more flexibility in the approach than people are giving it credit for. And again, I do think the second book is a way of kind of clarifying that, you know, because I think, especially with sentimental photographs and stuff like that, and I've debated that with people as well, that very issue. I have an old box of photographs full of, like, pictures of ex-boyfriends, and a lot of them are not very good pictures. You know, I really could keep about 5, and I think that would sort of get the gist of what was sweet or meaningful about the relationship, but like, I don't need every picture that he took of me sweeping the floor or whatever, you know. There's a lot of randomness.
And Have you done it? Have you done the KonMari method?
I actually don't. I've decluttered a lot. I've gotten rid of a lot of stuff after reading the book, but I didn't go so far as to roll my underwear into little tubes, although many of my friends did and seemed to love it. But I think that's an aesthetic thing that's appealing for a lot of people to have like a magazine sort of pretty life.
Right. Why are we so attracted to these things, and especially this time of year?
I think people just feel like they don't have control over their relationship to their belongings, and this gives them some kind of method to regain that. I mean, it does cheer you up to be in a tidier environment. I don't know if I would go so far as one of the women in the book who sort of describes having an apartment that looks like a hotel room. That's like taking it a bit too far. But, you know, the times that you are able to attain this sort of level of tidiness, and Kondo says that if you really do it right, you'll never go back. You know, I do think it's more calming and you feel like you can get more things done.
Yeah. And Tracy, it really is, if you commit to it, it seems to be a philosophy, a way of life, a religion.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the success of Oprah or anything like that, any sort of lifestyle guru, is that here is someone who seems to have figured it out. How to live, how to be, how things should look, how to organize them, and then here's this method to the madness, and that's really, really attractive. I think a lot of us just buy things without thinking about it because we think we want them or we're supposed to want them, and then we don't know what to do with it, and your life could really look like a magazine.
All right. Decluttering, its pros and cons. Laura Miller is the books and culture columnist for Slate.com, and Tracy Moore writes for Jezebel, and she's a staff reporter for Vocative. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Julie Myers is here now with the listener feedback. Hi.
Here to clutter up your feeds with mentions and retweets.
I see what you're doing there.
If somebody handed me that book, I would look at it. I would put it in my hands and I would look at it, and it would not inspire joy. So I would throw that away.
She advises that.
Right away.
Get rid of the book after you're done reading it.
Seriously?
Yeah, she says that in the book.
That's incredible. That's amazing. I guess if they end up in like secondhand bookstores and you can buy it that way, sure. Yeah, this is really just a like boon to secondhand bookstores.
Right.
She's part of the lobby for seconds. She's part of big used books. That's what it is. I called it.
Big used books.
You heard it here first.
I didn't know there was such a lobby.
There's a lobby,
there's
for,
a lobby
everything
for everything. That's
right.
True. Speaking of decluttering or the need for it.
That's
anyway.
Right. How about we declutter this conversation a bit and get to the mentions, the actual mentions? Well, of course, our listeners wanted to talk about the Marie Kondo way.
So, right.
Sanda Miriam says that Kondo comes from such a privileged position in her philosophy, she neglects what having things mean to non-bougie people. She says, you know, when I look through my grandma's old photos, it brings myself and my cousins extreme joy, and I'm so glad that she didn't throw them away, because what would we do with them? That's a pretty interesting point.
Right.
Heirlooms. Where would they be?
One man's trash is another man's treasure.
I'm part of Big Heirloom.
Another lobby we need to... declutter. Okay, thank you, Julie Myers. We're going to declutter the show right now and get out of here. So thanks a lot for listening. I'm Madeline Brand, and I will see you tomorrow.